In this upcoming season, we have a lot of exciting topics to consider, including a deeper look at particular sets of colleges and universities, such as the UCal schools, options for non-traditional students, and methods for improving admissions chances. But we begin by hosting Jennifer Benson to discuss therapeutic schools and treatment centers specifically. Jennifer has a master's in social work from Columbia University and practicum experience at Yale Child Study Center. As an associate member of the Independent Educational Consultants Association, Jennifer subscribes to their guiding ethics. She's also a member of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. She attends there and other professional conferences regularly, as well as participating in weekly continuing educational lectures. Prior to consulting, Jennifer directed communications and advancement for independent schools. She and her husband raised 4 children in a blended family and are now empty nesters living in Weston, Connecticut, with their 2 miniature white-haired dachshunds. Jennifer, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure being here.
So if you could maybe just explain your background and specifically what got you into educational consulting.
Yeah, first and foremost, I'm a mom, in addition to being a professional. And my husband and I have a blended family. We have 4 children. My husband has 2 and I have 2. And we blended those families when the kids were younger. And all 4 children had very different academic needs. 2 of our children really, really struggled with mental health issues. One of our children had significant learning disabilities. And our other child, our high-flying Ivy League child, also, you know, had some issues with anxiety. So, you know, across the board, I navigated their very different experiences and became very involved in the therapeutic school community and found that I was counseling parents a lot and realized that there was a need for what I do and entered the field of therapeutic educational consulting.
It seems like the care, I guess, and the amount of investment that we have in our own kids often kind of acts as that vehicle for passion for the careers that we end up going into.
Sure. And I think this goes, you know, we choose where we live, right? For our children, I live in Weston, Connecticut, which has a fantastic school district, like so many school districts in Fairfield County. And, you know, ironically, Weston worked for one of our 4 children. So it was really, you know, I can speak to that a little bit more, but our kids all had really different needs. And navigating that was a close to a 40-hour a week job.
I bet. So tell me a little bit about a school solution. It looks like it's composed of 2 consultants. Could you kind of describe that arrangement and, you know, what are you guys all about at the School Solution?
Yeah. So the School Solution was founded by Karen Mabey. Karen Mabey is also a clinician. She is a school psychologist, where my professional background is social work. You know, we take our clinical perspective very seriously because it allows us to really, you know, assess the needs of our clients, as well as the schools and programs that we send our children to, as well as particularly from a social work lens, I, you know, work with family systems and really, you know, it's just not the child, but the child is a member of a larger family and what is going on in the child's life will impact the larger family. So it's Karen founded the practice about 25 years ago. And has been involved in the therapeutic educational consulting field for a very long time. She is a former IECA president and has really, you know, been very instrumental in creating the ethics and principles behind the work that we do.
Well, absolutely. Well, that's great that you have that. I didn't know your background was in social work. I feel like that's somewhat rare. Educational consultants typically have more academic backgrounds. So having that dimension of that type of experience, I think, is quite valuable.
Very valuable, particularly in working with kids who have some therapeutic needs. I work with families who, you know, they've tried everything at home. So if a kid has mental health concerns, anxiety, depression, substance use, they've hired a local therapist. If they're having school issues, they've worked with the school to get accommodations for their child. And families come to me when nothing is working and they need more. So when a child really needs to be in an environment where the entire community is working to serve that child. So it has a lot of professionals, both in the academic setting, as well as in the residential setting, that can really support that child get better.
So you've kind of alluded to what my next question was, which is really what type of student that you focus on in the school solution. What would you say is your kind of your signature service? What happens? What does it look like when that sort of that process goes in an ideal way?
In an ideal way, I'll just tell you, when it's not ideal, it's a crisis, right? So I will get a call. The child is just refusing to go to school. That's one thing. That's a crisis in one extent, but another crisis may be their child has tried to harm themselves in a significant way and they're hospitalized. What does that look like then? Or they suspect that, you know, their child has a significant substance use disorder and that substance use disorder is getting in the way of some kind, or, you know, kids, unfortunately, sell drugs these days too. And so they're afraid that their child could get in trouble by hurting themselves or in trouble with the legal system, or they're just not able to thrive.
Yeah, that certainly does sound like a crisis. So in those crisis situations, you know, what is your role? How do you come in? And then how does that sort of resolve in an ideal world?
So I spend a lot of my time traveling, visiting therapeutic schools and programs across the country, in the Northeast, in the Midwest, in the South, and out West as well. And a lot of my time. So I'm really, really cognizant and aware of what those programs look like. And I know their clinical teams. I know what the facilities look like. And I know what their kids are like. But what happens when a parent comes to me is it's like a full download. I read any psychological or psychiatric reports. I speak with therapists. I speak with psychiatrists. I speak with academic professionals, teachers, anybody that can give me a lens into that child. If it's appropriate, I speak with siblings. You know, I speak with grandparents, parents, to really understand who that child is and what the needs are. And then I basically figure out the puzzle, what schools and programs are going to best meet that kid's needs and why. And I present that information to parents who ultimately make the decision as to what the best fit is for their child.
And then once they get there, I mean, I would think that many of these issues resolve if you've found a good fit.
Yeah, they do. I also stay with the family and I stay with the child throughout that placement. So I become part of the treatment team and I have regular meetings with the child's therapist, as well as the academic team, to make sure things are moving smoothly and that the child is making progress.
What is your kind of essential philosophy at the school solution? In other words, what kind of makes that organization unique, would you say?
It's really the heart. Both Karen and I had children who needed residential treatment and we're both clinicians. So it's really having a clinical lens, but also a parental lens. And we place children in environments where we would place our own children.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And that's kind of where we started this segment too, was thinking about the connection between our own kids. I really think it helps you empathize. Your capacity for empathy is just that much higher. It's hard to imitate those circumstances without.
Yeah, no, it's definitely helpful. It's also helpful to understand, you know, when a child has mental health needs, what sort of supports are going to be needed along the way. Like, yes, kids do get better, but if a kid has a propensity for anxiety and depression in a program, they're going to be learning tools to manage their anxiety, depression, but their bodies change. You know, their hormones and circumstances change too. you know, hopefully they're going to be recognizing their dreams, whatever that may be. If college is where that child needs to be, you know, what sort of supports are they going to be needed to make their college process successful?
Here are a couple of things that stuck out to me after the first segment of my conversation with Jennifer. First, I think that one of the themes of the conversation was really the importance of being a parent oneself before sort of engaging in this conversation about others, about kids who are really struggling with a lot of the things that really, as a parent, you sort of experience the gamut, particularly if you have a couple, two or three. So having that experience really gives you a sort of perspective and a background and an empathy, I think, that you would not normally have if you hadn't gone through it yourself. So when I'm looking at educational experts, consultants, etc., it always interests me, I suppose, that they have families of their own, particularly if they're sort of veterans of 2, 3, 4, even if you've gone that deep. That's such a close personal experience. And I think it really broadens your sort of understanding of the entire realm. Another thing that stuck out to me was the discussion about positive parenting in particular and sort of the generational impact that it's had on this upcoming generation of kids who are born maybe in the 2010s. What sort of impact that's going to have on them when really they were given the sort of keys to the kingdom in a lot of ways. You know, therapists or contemporary therapists anyways would suggest that empowering them is a great way to foster sort of maturity. And I think that's true to some degree, but I would question the impact of taking that a little bit too far and not setting boundaries at all. I think that pendulum has sort of swung back way too far in that direction. If you look across an entire generation, that not enough boundaries are being set, that there are a lot of kids that have simply run amok based on this sort of logic of empowerment. So I think it's important for parents of the upcoming sort of generation, the next 5 to 10 years, that they start to swing back the other direction a little bit to be able to provide some boundaries, you know, that may actually perhaps take agency away from young kids when they're not able to handle it in order to facilitate those boundaries. Now, are there like favorite options that you have for therapeutic schools? Do you have any go-tos for particular issues? Which institutions would you like to highlight?
Well, it's so individual and it's so dependent upon what the need is. You know, I visit about 70 programs a year. And so it's so dependent. Also, programs change and their milieu changes, right? So I want to make sure when I send a child to a program, they're going to have an appropriate friend group, right? So they're going to be other kids like them there. So they'll have appropriate peers, you know, and that changes. So it's a matter of really staying on the pulse and having the relationships with the programs to really assess if it's an appropriate environment for this specific client at that time.
How many therapeutic programs are you mentioned? You would go to about 70 a year. How many are we talking about in the United States?
Oh, there's so many. And bear in mind, I work with both adolescents and young adults. And, you know, for anxiety, OCD, depression, all the way to schizophrenia and high functioning autism spectrum and low functioning autism spectrum. You know, so it's just substance use recovery programs. For example, say I have a young man who's 20 years old and, you know, has an addiction. You know, I'd much rather send that 20-year-old young man to a program where there are going to be other young men as opposed to, you know, older men and older women. And because I want that young man to learn how to have fun while sober with other young men. Right.
But that demographic changes for that institution, obviously. Right.
Well, there are programs that just cater to young men in recovery or young women in recovery.
Right.
You know, versus like a 50-year-old Wall Street guy who's, you know, got a problem with alcohol and needs to dry out, you know.
Right. Which is much different. But I mean, I think your point basically is that cultures change. I mean, and they evolve. Yeah. And so that's why it's important to kind of have tabs on where things stand currently.
Right. You know, are there kids who, you know, are athletic that they can play sports with? Are there kids who are just really, really nerdy? And, you know, so it's nuanced.
Yeah. So we're talking about thousands of programs across the United States, you'd say, for the therapeutic programs?
Yeah. Now there's a trend too for shorter term care, which are insurance-based care.
They're called insurance-based care?
No, they're not called that. But it's not that I have a bias against those programs. I mean, they certainly can be very helpful. But generally, when you're dealing with adolescents with mental health needs, you know, there needs to be kind of a longer-term trajectory or longer-term approach.
I see. Is the intake process to these types of institutions, is it difficult? And, you know, how hard is that transition for that individual and the families too? How hard is it?
Sending a child to treatment is really hard. I would say that the programs really do a phenomenal job with intake. And bear in mind, as the consultant, like I manage a lot of that intake process too with the family and support the family along the way with the intake process. So, you know, I think programs, good programs, are really, really adept at meeting a child where they are at a given time. You know, generally, it takes some time for a child to adapt to being in program. And, you know, and parents struggle too, you know, with their child being in program. And parents need a lot of hand holding as well.
In what sort of ways?
There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of guilt sending your child to treatment. What did I do wrong? And in fact, you know, parents are so well-meaning and they've done everything in their power. And sometimes it just is the way it is. You know, so really, you know, working the parents through that, sometimes parents aren't on the same page. Dad feels this way. Mom feels this way. Grandparents are giving a lot of pressure. You know, parents also like, what do I tell my friends? What do I, you know, my kids in treatment? How do I deal with that?
Yeah.
I think one of the wonderful things about treatment programs too is that they do support the parents. They connect the parents with other parents who are going through the same thing. And so all of a sudden, these parents, when their kid is in treatment, have other parents that they could really like, they don't, and they really connect with and learn that they're not alone in the process.
Do you know other parents like me?
Yes.
They're fantastic.
Yes, they are fantastic. And exactly. And also, so there are organizations like that, but there are also, you know, within the program, there will be parent support groups where parents can talk to one another, but there will also be psychoeducation groups where parents learn. And it's very, very helpful.
Here's some things that stuck out to me after the second segment of my conversation with Jennifer. It struck me that as she was describing some of these candidates for therapeutic schools, what that sort of typical profile looks like, that it's not really all that different from things that I've seen in my own kids at lower levels and with other kids that I've tutored and interacted with my business. And, you know, I guess it's sort of a fine line between that sort of inability to control oneself and that turning to a sort of clinical level, to one where a school refusal turns into a severe problem, something that can't sort of be solved by parents and by perhaps lighter authority. We're talking about therapists on a weekly basis or on a part-time or outpatient basis. I think it's surprising to me how quickly you can kind of tumble into a place where it really interrupts your life. I feel like there's a finer line than perhaps we'd like to admit. So when to sort of pull that trigger is really kind of a curious decision to me too, because it's hard to tell what's normal and what's not. And when it is really interfering with one's life, I think that's a long built-up process that's happened over years. So sometimes when you've crossed over that line, it's very difficult to tell. Another thing that stuck out to me was that parenting is very much an exercise in learning what's normal. It is an insulated and isolating experience being a parent. Talk about the baby cave. I think that extends out into young childhood and even teenage years tend to silo off. Obviously, there's lots of opportunities for socializing and interacting with other parents, but you just don't get that lens into another family's sort of inner workings very often. There is a public persona for a family, and then there's what happens in the home when no one's around. And those tend to be two fairly distinct worlds. So I'm always trying to figure out what's normal. Like what looks insane to me in my own household might actually be fairly tame in another or fairly common across the spectrum. So that really sort of impacts the way that I would think about it. But I have no way of knowing. I only have the context of my own experience, which is 20 or 30 years old. And from a different generation. So very difficult to know what is normal. I think that's sort of an ongoing quest for all parents right now. If you had one piece of parting advice for parents of students who are potentially looking at these options or facing some of these issues, what would that be?
There are a lot of great resources. We'll get you the help you need, and it's going to be okay.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, normalizing. I feel like normalizing is really important. It's so easy to feel like the thing in front of you is entirely broken and like you're screwing up and like, you know what I mean? Like it's all your fault. It's so easy to feel like that as a parent.
Shame and fear, you know, they're really, really bad emotions in terms of mental health. And so I really work with parents when they say, I know this sounds horrible. I'm like, no, you're doing the best you can. And people truly do the best they can. Of course, you meet your outliers, but people are, for the most part, really well-intentioned and just doing the best that they can.
Right.
Giving them space and grace. And,
yeah. Right. Totally. And this is nothing, I don't want to necessarily knock people who don't have kids, because I mean, people make that decision all the time. But I feel like parenting looked a lot different when I wasn't a parent. it looked a lot easier. It was much easier to judge, you know, and talk about all the things that I would do differently. But then when you get there, you realize that it's a lot more difficult.
Sure. Look, my 24-year-old daughter criticizes my parenting style sometimes. And I'm like, just you wait, missy.
Yeah. I mean, when you really get down in there, I mean, and it's just on a minor scale, like with my, I have a sister, she had some kids, you know, and she was like feeding them like pancakes every morning for, you know, for breakfast with maple syrup. I'm like, jeez, you know, that's if I had a daughter like that, there's no way she'd be eating vegetables every morning, right? Yeah, right. And then I have a kid, and of course they're eating waffles for breakfast every morning. So, yeah, I feel like it is important to work with people who are parents, to be honest. You know, there certainly is expertise of those who don't. But I mean, I think it's really hard to have that empathy, that level of empathy, if you're not.
Yeah. I mean, experience, you know, that's part of the beauty of it too, right? And I think just in just understanding how, you know.
The humility.
It's the humility. And also, I mean, it's true of anything. So you never know what's going on in people's lives, right? And what their challenges and struggles are. And people do a really good job of putting on a good front. But, you know, most people do have struggles and challenges of one kind and the other. And so, you know, understanding like, no, hey, they may be acting this way because something's really atrocious going on in their life, you know?
Yeah. Here are some final thoughts that I had following my conversation with Jennifer. One thing in particular that she mentioned was dysregulation tends to be a theme these days. And a lot of the kids that she's running across that are in need of these therapeutic programs. And that's something certainly I think that I've experienced in my own life as well with my own kids. They tend to have fits that seem sort of beyond their age. You know, their maturity just does not seem to be there. It's sort of like a tantrum. And I mean, I think adults have tantrums too. I think you'd never fully grow out of that. But I think the length of those fits, the breadth, how much you lose it, the behaviors that you're taking during those things, how damaging they are to your relationships with other people, I think are all very exaggerated for what I would expect for particular age groups. You know, when I'm talking about my daughter of 11, I wouldn't expect her to have a fit where she's hitting other people. But that's, I guess, part and product of the pandemic and, you know, really the echoes of the same things that we're still seeing and experiencing. And it's the specter of mental health underlies really the whole beast of the post-pandemic era. It's something that we're going to be recovering from for a long time, whether we know it or not. Another thought that I had was about this sort of current contemporary crop of parents, shine one. She mentioned that they tend to have more empathy these days, which I think is true. Empathy and understanding, I guess, for one's emotions. And that's kind of like the big point of emphasis these days. But although I do think back on my parents and kind of what they went through and their experience and their context, and I'm fairly certain they felt like they were a lot better than their parents too, like that they had all these cutting edge parenting techniques and psychological approaches that would be very coddling and comforting to us, you know. So to some degree, I feel like every generation feels like they've got some secrets and doing things entirely different and much better than the previous one, which I'm not convinced that's necessarily true as a principle. I think the pendulum has swung towards more empathy and understanding, kindness. But I also think that our kids will grow up rolling their eyes at that and thinking about all the lack of boundaries and all the coddling that happened that did not allow them to grow up and be bitter about it later. I feel like that might be the kind of the prevailing emotion. And so I wonder if the next generation might flip back to a more authoritative form of parenting in 10 or 20 years. Another thing that stuck out to me was the influence of Paris Hilton and her campaign against mental health. I mean, I think that's fairly depressing that celebrity essentially has that type of impact over the mental health of our kids and of the next generation, that, you know, being popular and being viewed in a certain way by some media following gives you the authority to have a voice of some impact. Really, I guess, is the reality that we're living in. I think when TikTok stars are essentially calling the shot, it's what you'd call a kakistocracy, led by the least able to lead. Yeah, I hate that's the case, but I think it's incumbent upon, you know, individual parents like you and I to buck those trends, to see through it, to have the intelligence and the awareness to understand that a celebrity voice is not necessarily more right than yours.